somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation. Episode 14. Universal Peace. Religious Tolerance in the Mughal Empire. My ambition with this podcast is to provide a global history of free speech. Although I know full well that I'll never be able to give anything near an exhaustive account of all the events that have influenced and shaped the development of this principle. And even though we've visited the Abbasid Caliphate and made brief mentions of events in China, India, the Ottoman Empire, and the Byzantine Empires, I cannot deny that most episodes have centered on developments in the West. This is due to a mix of my vast ignorance of the history of many non-Western cultures, language barriers, and yes, that the development of free speech as an individual right, as far as I can decipher the historical record, primarily took place in the West. But for those who believe in the universality of free speech, developments outside the West are crucial. And among non-Western countries, India is perhaps the most important one. Not only is India a democracy situated in Asia and home to most of the world's Hindus, Sikhs, Jains, and the world's second largest population of Muslims. With more than 1.3 billion inhabitants, India has a huge impact on the practical and everyday exercise of free speech of almost 20% of the world's population. So when it comes to the status of global free speech, India is very much a crucial swing state. According to Freedom House, India has been rated a free democracy for almost 20 consecutive years. A powerful testament to the vibrancy of Indian democracy occurred on September 6, 2018, when India's Supreme Court declared India's ban on homosexuality for unconstitutional. As with some of the more controversial restrictions on free speech we'll touch upon, India's ban on homosexuality was not an expression of indigenous culture, but rather a holdover from British colonial rule. But when it comes to press freedom, the story is more complicated. On the one hand, Indians enjoy the most robust protection of free speech in South Asia. India has a thriving press catering to hundreds of millions of readers in numerous languages. And unlike most Western democracies, Indian newspapers have seen an increase in both print circulation and ad revenues. But on respect for press freedom, India is only ranked partly free, with a downward trajectory for the past several years. And despite the fact that India is formally a secular state with constitutional protections of freedom of religion and speech, one of the issues that still plague modern India is outbreaks of religious intolerance. Since gaining independence in 1947, several atrocities have been committed between Hindus, Muslims, and Sikhs, sometimes claiming hundreds or even thousands of lives. In 2017, Indian journalist Gauri Lankesh was shot to death by suspected Hindu extremists. And police have uncovered a hit list of secular intellectuals targeted for being enemies of Hinduism. In order to prevent outbreaks of religious intolerance, India has in place laws that prohibit religious insult and outrage. Some of these laws stem from British colonial rule. But critics argue that these laws can be abused to entrench rather than prevent intolerance. Even a massive Bollywood star like director, producer, and actor Aamir Khan has been on the receiving end of criminal investigations for his blockbuster movie PK, which satirizes superstition and organized religion. And human rights organizations have criticized a number of dubiously named religious freedom acts. These are state laws that limit the possibility of religious conversion, which critics argue are actually targeted at religious minorities. And just to prove the critics right, In 2018, the Sikh governor of Punjab presented a draft bill that prescribes life imprisonment for blaspheming against Sikh, Hindu, Muslim, and Christian holy texts. In fact, as we shall see, Indian laws on religious insult have even made it difficult for historians to write and discuss the material on which the story I'm about to tell is based. Just as in Europe, controversies over religious tolerance have deep roots in India. In the last two ordinary episodes, we explored a Europe gripped with violent intolerance in the slipstream of Luther's Reformation. But we also saw how tolerance dawned in places like Transylvania, Poland-Lithuania, and the Dutch Republic. And this provides a perfect opportunity to explore how the issue of religious tolerance played out around the same time in India. In a sense, it's a return to beginnings. As you may remember from episode 3, I briefly mentioned how the Indian king Ashoka turned from butchery to Buddhism and may well have been the first king on record to formalize religious tolerance in the 3rd century BC. Even if historians disagree on where the myth and realities of Ashoka's enlightened reign begins. In the 16th and 17th centuries, another famous Indian king, the Mughal Akbar the Great, would revive the idea of religious tolerance on the Indian subcontinent. Although Akbar was a Muslim, not a Buddhist, and probably had no idea about the religious policies of Ashoka. But Akbar's policy of universal peace was not to last, and other emperors gradually rolled back his reforms. In particular, Akbar's grandson, Aurangzeb, has been cast as an intolerant villain by subsequent historians. But the story might be a bit more complicated than the black and white picture of Akbar the Great and Aurangzeb the Bad. A note of caution. When I use the term tolerance to describe events in 16th century India, it does not confer the same meaning or share the same origins as modern liberal notions of tolerance. Nonetheless, I actually think the term is apt enough to describe some of the policies that I will delve into in this story. But first, many of us could probably need a little quick brush up on the history of the Mughal Empire, which I'm sad to say was not one of the subjects that my history teachers focused on. So apologies in advance when I mangle pronunciations and misunderstand details and context. As always, I welcome criticism and corrections and will confess any historically sinful acts and omissions in upcoming episodes. The Mughal Empire was one of the greatest and most powerful empires the world has ever seen. The Mughal Padshahs ruled over most of South Asia, no less than 3.2 million square kilometers from Kabul to Madras and from the Arabian Sea to the Gulf of Bengal at its zenith. By the late 1600s, the empire had a population of 100 to 150 million people. The Mughal Empire was founded in 1526 when Babur toppled the Delhi Sultanate. Babur was an Islamic Turco-Mongol warlord from present-day Uzbekistan. Babur's Mongol roots is actually the reason why we still call his dynasty the Mughals, which is the Persian version of Mongol. Some people come from a long family of doctors, tailors, or carpenters. But Babur was born to conquer. His grandfather was none other than Timur, or Tamerlane, the great Central Asian conqueror. And on his mother's side, he was related to the conqueror, Genghis Khan. Following the family tradition, Babur set out from Samarkand via Kabul to conquer northern India. And Babur was decidedly not tolerant. In his famous autobiography, Baburnama, he describes how his army of Islam waged war on the accursed infidel foes of Muhammad's religion, and how after defeating a Hindu army, mounds were made of the bodies of the slain, pillars of their heads. Babur's son, Humayun, took a serious beating in 1540 and had to spend the next 15 years in exile. Most of that time was spent at the court of the Safavid Persian Shah, giving the Mughals a strong Persian flavor. When Humayun returned from his exile, he reconquered his father's kingdom, but soon died when he fell down the stairs of his library. Quite an ironic end for a man whose name means the lucky one. Humayun's 13-year-old son, Akbar, inherited the keys to the family enterprise in 1556. And this is where our story really begins. Akbar has gone down in history as Akbar the Great. His first name, Akbar, also means greater or the greatest. So we're dealing with a guy called Greatest the Great. Akbar was already a legend in his own lifetime. Though born into a highly literate family, he never learned how to read. At least four tutors tried and failed. Some historians think he was dyslexic. But that didn't stop Akbar from becoming an enthusiastic sponsor of science, poetry, philosophy, music, and art. He was also said to be quite a hunk, and true to his Mughal heritage, he was a natural-born and often ruthless general who conquered huge parts of the Indian subcontinent. But what made Akbar truly remarkable, and relevant for this podcast, was that he came to favor a particular version of religious tolerance. Although he was by all accounts a pious Orthodox Muslim and much less tolerant in his early years. The Mughals were a Muslim elite, vastly outnumbered by Hindus, Jains, and other religions. The emperor depended heavily on the Islamic establishment, the ulama, for legitimacy and political support. In return, the ulama expected a say in the empire's policies in order to keep it on the straight and narrow path of Islamic orthodoxy, not least on the question of the non-Muslim majority, or the Dhimmi. The Dhimmi question would bring Akbar in conflict with the ulema again and again. The first time was in 1563, when a young and still pious Akbar abolished taxing Hindu pilgrims. But these were mere baby steps on Akbar's eclectic journey towards religious heterodoxy, curiosity, and tolerance. A contemporary historian describes how with time Akbar would come to stress reason over tradition when it came to understanding religion, and how he called for abandoning the studies of the Quran and Hadith and favoring the useful disciplines of philosophy, mathematics, medicine, history, and poetry. Contrary to the wishes of hardliners, he also allowed Hindus to build and repair their temples. He made it illegal to convert non-Muslim slaves against their will. And Hindus who'd been forced to convert to Islam were allowed to reconvert without risking the Sharia-imposed death penalty for apostates. On a more symbolic level, Akbar provoked the ulema by celebrating Hindu festivals like the Diwali Festival of Light, and letting the poets at his court write daring poetry in favor of tolerance and against orthodoxy. By the grace of love, we made peace with the universe. Be thou an enemy and enjoy peace with us, wrote one poet. When the mullahs reacted furiously at the impious license of the poets, one of them responded,
"We drink for the blindness of the mullahs."
Increasingly frustrated with the ulama, Akbar was curious to hear what other religions had to offer. In 1575, he started a form of religious think tank. He built a large hall called the House of Worship, where he would host discussions of religion and theology. With time, priests from a wide range of different religions were invited to come and debate their beliefs, as well as philosophy, history, and science. He invited Shiites, Hindus, Parsis, Jains, and Catholic Jesuits. On freespeechhistory.com, you'll find a painting of the Jesuit priest sitting on Persian rugs in front of Akbar's throne. Akbar's court historian Abu Fasl writes that the emperor's court
became the home of the inquirers of the seven climes and the assemblage of the wise of every religion and sect. Reason was exalted, and the bigoted ulama and lawyers of orthodoxy found their positions difficult to defend.
And orthodox Muslim scholars complained that the participants in these discussions
only settled things with appeal to man's reason.
Akbar also opened a translation bureau and had important books from all different religions translated into Persian, the language of the Mughal court. Okay, I know this might be stretching it too far, but a comparison with the Abbasid caliphates and the translation movement is tempting. Although Akbar's efforts clearly did not have the same huge cross-civilizational impact as the Arab translations and transmission of Greek science and philosophy. Akbar's curiosity had personal reasons as well as political. He went through a number of spiritual crises throughout his life, and some historians think he suffered from mild epilepsy and depression. And one of Akbar's wives was a Hindu, who may also have influenced his outlook on religious affairs. The conflict between Akbar and the ulema reached fever pitch in 1578. A Brahmin priest was accused of insulting the name of the Prophet Muhammad. As we saw in episode 5, according to the dominant schools of Islamic law, such blasphemy is punishable by death, which is why jihadists still hunt for blasphemers on the streets of Dhaka, Islamabad, Paris, and Copenhagen. In spite of Akbar's open disapproval, an Islamic judge defied the emperor and imposed the ultimate penalty on the priest. Next year, Akbar issued an imperial edict declaring himself the supreme arbiter of religious affairs. He gave himself authority above the ulema body of theologians and scholars, and he even declared himself caliph, the supreme leader of Islam. Again, I might be straining my analogies beyond the historically defensible, but you might say there's a certain resemblance with how in the 9th century the Abbasid caliph al-Ma'mun and conservative religious scholars clashed over whether the Quran was the created or uncreated word of God, in a power struggle in order to determine whether it was the philosophically and rationalistic inclined caliph or the orthodox ulema who got to interpret Islamic law, as we explored in episode 5. The same year, Akbar abolished the jizya, a tax on non-Muslims. In practice, he declared dhimmis for equal subjects. To Akbar's supporters, he was the perfect man, the Insan al-Kamil, who would bring peace between Hindus and Muslims. But the ulema wasn't too happy. Akbar not only flouted orthodoxy, he had also assumed a role suspiciously close to that of a deity, which didn't sit too well with the Quran's central tenet that there's no God but Allah. An Islamic judge in Jaunpur even issued a fatwa calling for all good Muslims to rise and rebel against the infidel emperor. As he removed himself further and further from orthodox Islam, Akbar became more tolerant of non-Muslim beliefs and opposed to strict orthodoxy. He gradually evolved a concept of sulh-i kull, or universal peace. According to Abu Fasl, sulh-i kull was the search for truth and an attempt to dispel the darkness of the age by the light of universal toleration. An orthodox Muslim historian angrily wrote that a central part of the policy was that no man should be interfered with on account of his religion, and anyone was allowed to go over to any religion he pleased. But Akbar's universal peace was about more than simply preventing sectarian conflict or tolerating all beliefs. It also meant abandoning dogmatic scripturalism in favor of open-mindedness and reason in search for a common ground, treating all religions as different ways of reaching the same God. Again, if you're an Orthodox religious judge and scholar of a monotheistic faith whose holy book claims to be the one and universal truth as revealed by God to his chosen and last prophet, you're obviously not going to be happy to suddenly share the spotlight with infidels, heretics, and apostates. As Akbar learned more of the different religions, he created his own eclectic religion named Din-il-Ilahi, which means divine faith in Persian. An eclectic mix and match of a pacifist strand of Islamic Sufism, Hinduism, a dash of Zoroastrianism, and perhaps some Catholicism. It focused, among other things, on worshipping light and the sun. There is disagreement among scholars on whether Akbar was merely heterodox, heretical, or an outright apostate. Historian André Wink seems to find the evidence that Akbar actually left Islam compelling. and Muslim historians of the time painted a picture of Akbar as an apostate and indeed a tyrant who purged Islamic practices from the court and persecuted Orthodox Muslims. But Akbar's own historian, Abu al-Fasl, refuted these accusations of intolerance by insisting that the enmity from Muslim hardliners was due to Akbar's tolerant disposition, which led him to receive all classes of mankind with affection. But interestingly, Fasl also cites Akbar himself as stating that, "Formerly, I persecuted men into conformity with my faith and deemed it to be Islam. As I grew in knowledge, I was overwhelmed with shame. Not being a Muslim myself, it was unbecoming for me to force others to become such. What constancy is to be expected from proselytes by compulsion?" In this quote, Akbar not only seems to acknowledge his own apostasy, he also advances an idea of toleration, repudiating compulsion and force, a view that would take almost a century to reach for the supposed grandfather of tolerance, John Locke. And there's also a resemblance with how Ashoka seemingly repudiated his violent ways in favor of peace and tolerance. Akbar's policy not only deviated from the intolerance demanded by Orthodox Islamic scholars, Akbar's subjects also enjoyed considerably more religious freedom than those living in Goa, the capital of Portuguese India, ruled by the Catholic King of Portugal. The Portuguese saw Indians as barbarous hordes and infidel dogs, to whom the Portuguese had come to spread the Christian faith. And by spreading the faith, the Portuguese did not have in mind persuasion. Instead, the king ordered all Hindu temples closed. The church forbade Muslims and Hindus from public worship, while Christians were forbidden from using infidel servants, doctors, and even barbers. In March 1594, Akbar sent a letter to Shah Abbas of Persia, scolding his royal colleague for intolerance. He argued that his own acceptance of all beliefs and cultures gave him the moral authority to rule all of mankind.
"It has been our disposition from the beginning not to pay attention to differences in religion and variety of manners, and to regard the tribes of mankind as the servants of God. We have endeavored to regulate mankind in general."
Akbar even tried to convince Spain's fanatically intolerant King Philip II about the value of tolerance. In 1581, Philip had acquired the Portuguese throne and thereby Goa, making him Akbar's new neighbor. In 1582, Akbar sent a letter lecturing Philip.
"As most men are fettered by bonds of tradition and by imitating the ways followed by their fathers, ancestors, relatives, and acquaintances, everyone continues, without investigating the arguments and reasons, to follow the religion in which he was born and educated, thus excluding himself from the possibility of ascertaining the truth, which is the noblest aim of human intellect. Therefore, we associate at convenient seasons with learned men of all religions, thus deriving profit from their exquisite discourses and exalted aspirations."
Philip must have choked on his red wine when he read Akbar's letter. He wasn't exactly famous for his tolerance. He fiercely promoted the Spanish Inquisition, and as we saw in episode 11, is said to have laughed when thousands of French Protestants were slaughtered in 1572. To make matters worse, Akbar's letter came only a year after Philip had seen those heretical Calvinists in the United Dutch provinces secede from his staunchly Catholic empire. Tolerance, schmollerance. When it came to religious heterodoxy, Philip preferred the Inquisition and Index over ecumenical Kumbaya. As we've seen time and again along this journey, if we expect early champions of tolerance to live up to modern liberal principles, we're bound to get disappointed. So before the story of Akbar gets a little too rosy, we have to remember that Akbar was a pre-modern, absolutist warrior king whose legitimacy depended partly on military conquest. He expanded his empire by the sword, not peaceful negotiations, and he punished disobedience with brutality. When one of his officers disobeyed him, he threw him out of a tower window into a courtyard. When the officer survived, he was dragged up the stairs, thrown out the window again to ensure that he died. And after Akbar crushed the rebellious ruler Uday Singh in a jihad in the 1560s, his troops slaughtered between 20 and 25,000 civilians for aiding the resistance. And religious tolerance was premised on submission to Akbar's rule. And when he came to favor religious toleration, that did not translate into anything like individual rights or free speech. Mullahs, who opposed his heterodoxy and tolerance towards non-Muslims, were sometimes banished or imprisoned, and he headed a strictly hierarchical society of castes where sex slaves were a part of most noble households. Akbar's universal religion may also have served to create a personal cult around the emperor, perhaps not unlike the ones we see from populist authoritarians around the world today. He turned himself into a semi-god and made selected members of the nobility his disciples by making them swear to give up life, property, honor, and even religion. After placing their heads on the emperor's feet, they were given a small portrait of Akbar to wear on their turbans. Akbar's search for a universal religion also made him engineer an appalling experiment. In the late 1570s, he shut a group of children up in an isolated house and instructed the nurses not to communicate with them. He wanted to see what religion they would choose and what creed they would repeat. Tragically, when the children were let out after 3 to 4 years, they had become deaf and dumb, and some of them died. Still, it's fair to say that the level of religious tolerance and heterodoxy showed by Akbar was far ahead of most contemporary states in Europe who fiercely enforced the principle of cuius regio, aius religio, as we saw in episodes 10 and 11. Akbar died from dysentery on October 25, 1605, leaving the empire to his son Jahangir. Now, when your dad has the Great attached to his name, his shoes must be pretty much impossible to fill out. And Jahangir proved to be a disappointment. Maybe this is the reason why he became an opium addict and a heavy wine drinker. And apparently, Jahangir was one of those drunks who becomes petty and nasty rather than fun and generous. When the governor of Bengal became a little too critical, Jahangir imposed strict censorship on the governor and his news writer. He also persecuted the fifth guru of the new Sikh faith, Guru Arjun. When Arjun blessed a rebellious prince with a finger mark of saffron, the emperor retaliated by confiscating Arjun's property and children before ordering him killed. Arjun wasn't going to be the last Sikh martyr to fall victim of Mughal persecution. But more on that later. Even though Jahangir was less tolerant than Akbar and committed cruel acts, 17th century English travelers to India portrayed the Mughal Empire as exceptionally tolerant. A most fascinating example is the English traveler Thomas Coriat, who spent the last 2 years of his life roaming Jahangir's empire. Coriat was something of a religious bigot, but unlike his time in the Ottoman Empire, he could vent his anti-Islamic feelings openly in Mughal India. In one diatribe, he went full Westboro Baptist Church and described Muhammad in very unflattering terms and ended by saying that if only Indian Muslims knew the truth about Muhammad, "I am persuaded that thou wouldest spit in the face of thy Quran and trample it under thy feet." But Coriat took it even further and pulled off a stunt that makes Charlie Hebdo look positively pious. Coriat climbed up a tall building facing a minaret, and when the Muslim muezzin called out the Islamic prayer, "No God but one God and Muhammad," Coriat heckled him by shouting,
"No God but one God and Christ the Son of God."
Coriat admitted that if he had
spoken thus much in Turkey or Persia against Muhammad, they would have roasted me upon a spit. But in the Mughals' dominions, a Christian may speak much more freely than he can in any other Mohammedan country in the world.
that Coryat could get away with openly vilifying and mocking Allah, the Quran, and Muhammad is incredible, taking into account what would have happened if he had done so today in countries like Saudi Arabia, Iran, or Pakistan, where blasphemy is punishable by death. He might even have ended up facing serious consequences in contemporary England. Just ask Salman Rushdie. When Jahangir died, his sons fought a nasty battle for the throne. Jahangir's son Khurram won and was named Emperor Shah Jahan. The new emperor certainly didn't inherit his grandfather's religious tolerance. His rule was marked by an orthodox Sunni Muslim backlash against the policies of Akbar. Shah Jahan didn't act alone. He represented a general sentiment among India's orthodox Sunni Muslims who took a strong anti-Hindu and anti-Shia stance in their promotion of Sharia law. Shah Jahan explicitly revised some of Akbar's Dhimmi policies. In 1633, the emperor reimposed the restrictions on building and repairing non-Muslim temples. And when he learned about a project of completing a group of unfinished Hindu temples, he ordered the most recently built ones destroyed. Apart from his piety, Shah Jahan is best known for his astonishing building projects. Taj Mahal, the Peacock Throne, and the Red Fort in Delhi are probably the best known examples. The sons of Shah Jahan followed the family tradition and fought an even nastier battle for the throne. In fact, Shah Jahan wasn't even dead before the emperor was divided into two factions, each backing their favorite prince. The oldest prince, Dara Shikoh, was open-minded and intellectually curious. He followed the footsteps of his great-grandfather, Akbar, and translated ancient Hindu scripts into Persian. He also echoed Akbar when he argued that the essence of Hinduism is identical to Islam. Dara was supported by a wing of nobles, officials, and scholars in favor of Akbar's lenient policies. But Dara's younger brother, Prince Aurangzeb, was an orthodox Muslim hardliner like his father. He was supported by a more conservative wing of nobles, officers, and members of the ulema who called for a traditional Sharia state. After a long conflict, Aurangzeb and the conservative wing won the War of Succession. One of their first deeds was capturing Prince Dara. He was paraded through Delhi on an elephant before the ulema condemned him to death for apostasy and idolatry, a highly symbolic break with Akbar's universal peace. Aurangzeb is the only emperor to remotely challenge Akbar in terms of historical bandwidth. And as I mentioned in the introduction, Aurangzeb often serves as Akbar's counterimage. Where Akbar is famous for his tolerance, Aurangzeb is infamous for his intolerance. Where Akbar is hailed as a national hero, Aurangzeb is a national villain. An important reason for his bad rep is his Islamization of the empire along much more strict and orthodox lines, including the revival of the discriminatory Dhimmi taxes Akbar had removed. He also issued an edict commanding provincial governors to fire Hindu officials and replace them with Muslims. Sikhs were targeted too. When Aurangzeb learned that the guru Tek Bahadur converted Muslims, he ordered the guru arrested. In November 1675, a Sharia judge sentenced the Sikh guru and five of his companions to death for blasphemy. Aurangzeb had created a second martyr of Sikhism. But as intolerant as Aurangzeb's Sharia state was, many modern historians think some of his misdeeds have been blown out of proportion. For instance, historian Audrey Trushka has found no evidence that Aurangzeb ordered mass-scale conversions on pain of death, as is popularly believed. Instead of using the stick of forced conversions, it seems Aurangzeb used the carrot by rewarding converts with the promotions and cash prizes. Although some of his officials did force conversions, like a Sharia judge in Surat who harassed the city's Hindu merchants, giving them a choice between converting or paying him ransom money, and blackmailing others with threats of desecrating their temples. But instead of approving, Aurangzeb replaced the corrupt judge with a more moderate one. Another account challenged by modern historians is that Aurangzeb destroyed thousands of Hindu temples. According to scholar Richard Eaton, only about a dozen temple destructions can actually be confirmed. And in 1659, early in his career, Aurangzeb actually issued an imperial decree ordering local officials to leave Hindu temples and their caretakers alone. So while Orthodox Islam played a much more prominent role under Aurangzeb, what Andre Wink calls secular toleration of Hindus and non-Muslims remained the general policy of the Mughals even after the death of Akbar and the demise of his universal peace. And so even towards the end of the 17th century, the British sea captain Alexander Hamilton, no, not that Hamilton, who spent 35 years travelling East India, could write that in the town of Surat,
there are above 100 different sects, but they never have any hot disputes about their doctrine or way of worship. Everyone is free to serve and worship God their own way, and persecutions for religion's sake are not known among them.
As I mentioned in the beginning, India still seems to struggle with the limits of religious tolerance and free speech. And in fact, the very history of the Mughal Empire that I have foolhardily waded into is so contested that scholars have to tread very carefully indeed. In 2003, the American scholar James Lane published a book on Shivaji, a Hindu king who fought a David and Goliath battle against Aurangzeb and is hailed as a national hero. After the book was published, individuals and institutions on Lane's thank you list became victims of vigilante attacks, presumably from religious extremists. A Sanskrit professor was attacked with tar, and an archive of invaluable manuscripts was vandalized. Scholars are also forced to silence with Section 295A of the Indian Penal Code, one of the colonial-era religious insult laws I mentioned in the beginning. It punishes anyone who writes or speaks with deliberate and malicious intent of outraging the religious feelings of one class of citizens of India. Offenders are punished with a fine or up to 3 years of imprisonment. Whatever constitutes as deliberate and malicious intent is of course highly subjective and wide open to interpretation in a country with so many people of different faiths and cultures. In 2017, historian Audrey Truske, whom we've already mentioned, published a book on Aurangzeb, which underwent a so-called legal read by a lawyer whose job it is to single out problematic passages to be edited or erased in order not to risk falling afoul of Indian laws. For the Indian edition, Truske had to remove certain parts concerning the controversial Hindu hero Shivaji, the same hero who got James Lane and the Sanskrit professor in trouble. Otherwise, Truske's book risked the same fate as The Hindus, An Alternative History by Wendy Doniger, a leading scholar on Hinduism from University of Chicago. In 2010, Section 295A was used against her book, which caused outrage for quoting a 19th century Hindu monk as saying, "Give me beef." Nobody questioned the validity of the quote, but apparently truth mattered less than offending religious sentiments. After fighting for 4 years, the Indian publisher agreed to withdraw Wendy Doniger's book and destroy the remaining copies. But even after Truske had removed the offending passages from her book, she was systematically attacked by Twitter trolls and had to cancel planned talks in India due to protests from religious extremists. It seems that modern India can still benefit from the rich heritage of Ashoka and Akbar. Thank you very much for listening. Today's episode was edited by Søren Stehøj, and Matthias Meyer contributed with essential research. Join us next time as we move back to the West and developments in 17th century England. If you like what you heard, please give us a review on iTunes and like and share on your social media platforms.